Welcome to this latest edition of the Positive Populist Podcast. I have to be very careful how I say that. Look who's here. I'm going to say your Twitter handle. Hey, Tammy Bruce.
That's right. That's right. Convenient, isn't it?
I always loved that way of, it just makes me smile every time I see it and think of you.
Well, you know, great. What I liked about it and the point of it was, even though it was like many more extra letters when they used to count it in the Twitter elements, was that it kind of imbued a casual framework of a conversation.
Yes.
So I like to promote that as much as I can.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
So I start every conversation with this question. Hey, Tammy Bruce, are you a positive populist?
You know, I think so. And what's interesting is that it really does lend itself to more of a personal point of view. Mm-hmm. But I think that that actually has got to be at the foundation of the idea of populism, mm-hmm. right? Is that our point of view, the nature of how we're seeing things matters. But at the same time, of course, there's a specificity to the nature of what it promotes, which is, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when I think of populism, I think of decision making and policy that really is geared toward what's best for the population mm-hmm. at large, that's not really geared for control issues, that does not lend itself to more government control. Mm-hmm. So it really is kind of all the best parts of conservatism.
Yes.
Which presumes, for conservatism really to even work, which looks at, of course, and requires small government, is that it presumes that the average individual can run their own lives.
Yes, you got it. Totally got it.
And populism relies on that as well.
Absolutely. So for me, it's all about, I know it sounds like a cliche, but when you really drill into it, it really means people power, putting power in the hands of people. And then from a policy agenda, that gets you into really exciting territory, like decentralizing power, not just from the federal government to the states, but to local communities. So people, but also through the market. That's
right,
why it's conservative in the end. You know, that's why I love that phrase, is the best part of conservatism. That's very cool.
But I would caution, though, and to some degree for America, as a nation that's based in an idea that structure is important. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the uniqueness. It's no other country in the world, you know, where there's usually a common history, you know, England, a common language, that you have a history that binds you together. We have more of that now, but we're still really a puppy. So I am a fan of the role of government, mm-hmm. but what I'm not a fan of is the government naturally growing into thinking that it's the thing that matters.
Yeah, and there's way too much of that.
Yes.
But what I really want to start with now, when we get into the you know, the real sort of details of this, is what, like, your political journey, because one of the things I'm always, you mention it every now and again when we're talking, and when I've seen you on other shows talking about current issues, one of mm-hmm. the things that you bring is an understanding of the left, because that's where you once were. Tell us that story. It's so interesting.
Well, you know, it's interesting, my politics really haven't changed. And I still see this happening to this day, is that leadership mm-hmm. in the left misleads people.
Right.
And they claim to represent something that the left ultimately can't deliver, which is personal freedom. Uh-huh. The left ends up relying on government controls, bigger government, and really ultimately the belief that the elite really are better than everyone else mm-hmm. and that everyone else needs them. It is, of course, the antithesis of what the left purports to stand for.
Yeah.
And so for me as a young person, you know, I come in, some people would describe me as a classical liberal, but as a conservative, it really is just has been a shift to my realization mm-hmm. that it's the conservative ideal that my beliefs, that my principles really fit well within, which is the importance of personal freedom combined with responsibility, the importance of the market, maintaining that freedom, and the ultimate end result really of any government is tyranny, is that it grows into believing that it's necessary mm-hmm. and it grows into resenting forces that want to limit it. And so for me, this has always been, which I thought was about liberalism. Many of us thought that was liberalism, but it really isn't.
So when was that? When did you think that?
Well, most of my young adult life, but being in the National Organization for Women, working with leftist and just even liberal, Democrat, liberal leaders, I became quite aware of the fact of the fraud.
But how did you get
happening.
Into it? I'm interested how you how got into, I got into the first place.
Oh,
yeah,
well,
what were you doing with these terrible
Yeah,
things?
Look, I was in public relations as my trade.
Yeah.
And I was sitting on my couch in West Hollywood.
Yeah.
And there was a group called Operation Rescue, which was a group of men, white men primarily, who were physically blocking women's health care centers.
Right.
They were pro-life. Their argument was that they were just simply going to stop women from accessing these buildings. Now, for me, and I was not really political very much. I mean, I was a feminist. When you're young, you're in Los Angeles. You are. And but what struck me was the inherent unfairness of that. I thought to myself, how does that help the issue? Right? How does that change anything? These are bullies.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I think that is. For Americans in general, we want fairness. No matter where we find ourselves on a political spectrum, it's really a nonpartisan concern in that whatever we believe, we rely on goodwill and trusting each other. And that what we know that you can disagree on the issues, but let's not be unfair and let's not be bullies about what it is we're trying to accomplish. So I saw this unfolding on local news.
Yeah.
And I remember the moment I actually sat up on my couch and I decided then, and I didn't see anyone in Los Angeles. There was no organized effort to counter them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I've always given money at the time to certain groups like the ACLU and the National Organization for Women. And I thought, speaking as a capitalist, I thought, where's my money been going? what have I gotten for my dollar? Not much. So I went to some meetings, and it became very clear National Organization for Women, primarily. That was like the one kind of active group in Los Angeles.
How did you find them?
What at the time, the phone book.
Okay.
You remember the phone book?
No, I'm so interested because that takes a bit of... You know, effort, right? You can't.
Oh, yes.
So you saw this going on. I want to do something about it. This is outrageous.
Yes.
And you looked up the national.
I looked them, and I'd given money previously. So they're. So I was maybe they had sent out a newsletter every now and then. So I knew they were around.
Right.
And I think maybe the news had interviewed somebody.
Got it. Okay. Oh, so it's kind of on your radar.
Yeah. And so I went in. Interestingly, not really. In a lot of, not on the issue. It wasn't like, oh my God, I've got to protect abortion.
Yeah.
It wasn't that.
Yes.
It was about what is this mob doing in my town? And so it was an education. A year later, I was the president of the Los Angeles chapter of NOW.
Okay.
Because there was, we see it even to this day, that there's like bureaucracies.
Yes.
And what I'd ultimately learned was it was always about raising money and the internal machinations of things. I came in on it with a desire to solve a particular problem.
Yeah.
And we know that that's also not the agenda necessarily of either side of the aisle, which is to solve problems. So that's how I got directly involved.
And then how did you continue your professional career?
Yes, did both, yes.
And then you were running the Los Angeles chapter or whatever they called it.
Yes.
And then what happened?
Well, had some tremendous successes, really focused on issues of the image of women in media, violence against women, issues where there was some general universal support that were really not being advocated on, issues of, you know, the workplace, child care, the availability of child care, things like that. And then O.J. Simpson. Killed his ex-wife.
Okay.
So, but that fit well within the bailiwick of what I'd been working on in L.A., which is, again, the issues of violence in general, stranger violence, issues of rape, legislation and just issues to have it be something. So I saw it as an epidemic. Clearly it was and it is. So suddenly this happens in, you know, Los Angeles is like a mining town. I mean, everybody knows everyone else. It's a town of film and television.
Yes.
And so when that occurred, O.J. Simpson was, a favorite son, very well liked and very successful. And a lot of us did not know the background of the nature of what was happening there. But it became certainly an issue about domestic violence. And so that certainly from 94 on became a major issue, obviously, with the trial getting into I'd actually was considering at that point not running again for chapter president, going to law school.
Okay.
And then in the midst of all of that, I got to know the legal system in LA, and I was disabused of that notion very quickly. So that was a big education and a very successful effort here to focus on the issue of domestic violence, how it's a colorblind crime, how it is something that can and does affect women. It doesn't matter how rich you are or where you come from socioeconomically or what the color of your skin is. And this is the kind of thing that women experience as women.
Yeah.
So it was a very important conversation and experience. At the same time, the national leader at the time thought, ooh, I was gearing up to run for president of NOW. And so they began to cast this as that because they saw this as more of a racial problem for some inexplicable reason, because Mr. Simpson, of course, African-American man. And of course, I was working on the issue of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of advocacy for people of color, and that's good in this country. My advocacy was for women, regardless of complexion. But that became a huge internal fight. I ended up spending more of my time fighting internally, and that wasn't what interested me. And so I resigned, and I was on talk radio at the time here on a station called KFI.
You had a show on
Yes.
So how did that happen? I mean, you missed that whole bit out.
I've been busy.
Right.
There was some demonstration here in Los Angeles. And I had they had called me. They wanted me to be a guest on, at the time, Daryl Gates, who was the chief of police here in Los Angeles. And apparently my arguments were so good, and I'd kind of made him speechless, that they offered me a weekend show.
Wow, just like that, from one appearance.
Well, they'd known me, that particular appearance, and they knew me. Because, look, I was, the feminist go-to person. And it worked out very well. As you can tell, I'm talking and I can't shut up because I'm Scottish. And so it worked out. It worked out quite well. So that began. I'd done a lot of media based on the issues, right, and my activism. But that kind of launched the separate efforts on media for myself.
So then you got the show, and then you resigned from NOW.
Yes.
National Organization. And then what's the next move?
Well, that was a very good question. I was well enough known here in Los Angeles to where I couldn't get a regular job. And I was on radio for a period of time. And ultimately, though, what I ended up doing was, because I needed to make some money, I wrote a book. And it was because it was the only way I could pay my rent.
Okay.
Because I don't like writing. I find it difficult in the process.
Yes.
And yet, you get into a zone.
I was going to say, I literally was about to ask you that. Is it one of those things where you can't get down to it once you're in it?
Yes.
It's the same.
And this is the problem for us who live in that world, is that the idea of it before you're in the zone, it's like, no.
Yes. Constant procrastination.
You have to remember what it's like to get in that space. And I was lucky enough to become friends with Ray Bradbury, the famous author. Mr. Bradbury, God bless his heart, he was like the dad I never had, but he loved writing.
Uh-huh.
He never understood why I hated it. And he would write every single day. And he would write the short stories and plays, and it was just magnificent. And I'm just not that way. and so I've written three books ultimately, and I need to do another one. But it is about sitting down, finding your space and finding yourself, getting into that zone, and then it happens. It's like a child that ends up getting a life of its own. Each of my books, I started thinking one thing,
and
it became something different in the process. So I'm glad I'm not alone in that
but
struggle.
But with the novels?
Well, nonfiction.
Yeah.
Novels, it's interesting. That could be even easier. Because it's then up to you, right? The structure, the nature of what's going on. But in doing nonfiction and wanting to talk about the issues and having a certain agenda. I've got opinions and I want to be able to express those. And I have a certain kind of experience that I think is valuable in helping people determine what's happening. And even with that, it's for me, even writing brings up things. When I was writing my second book, things came up that I had forgotten about entirely. Mm-hmm. And one thing in particular that I had put out of my mind because it was so shocking to me. Can I tell you?
Yes, please.
It was The Death of Right and Wrong is the second book, the on the issue of the rise of moral relativism. And in this writing on the various issues, I had remembered that there was an abortion doctor here in Los Angeles who had been killing women during the operations. Mm. And there was a number of women who just never came out of the clinic.
Wow.
And there was a protest by the pro-life people against him. And I went to one of the founders of NOW and my mentor and said to her, this is a great opportunity to work together with these individuals on a common goal mm-hmm. about women's lives. I was very excited. Yeah. I was like, wow. I mean, they're doing this protest. We should be doing this protest because after all, we're for women. And let's do some outreach and join them. And we can get this guy, you know, in jail.
Yeah.
And she said to me, oh, no, because that would hurt the issue too much. And I said,
What?
That's what I said. What? And she said, look, if we are promoting and bringing attention to, that if this happens with abortion, we're going to, you know, it's a very different kind of, angle. And I said, women are dying.
That's absolutely amazing.
I said to her, this has nothing to do with abortion. This has to do with a bad doctor.
Yes.
Well, yeah, there were several moments in my experience where that kind of thought pattern was so abhorrent. But it was interesting, in writing my second book, I'd remembered that conversation, but I had in fact, pushed it so far back because I didn't resign after that point. I was, remained a part of this. And it was things like that, that for me were obviously had chosen to forget, that showed me that it wasn't really about women. Mm. It wasn't really about improving the quality of women's lives. Mm. Abortion was the one thing that you could raise the most money on.
Do you know what? It's so interesting to hear you tell that story, Tammy, because it now really explains why when you talk about the issues we discussed today, the contemporary, whether it's immigration or whatever it may be, mm-hmm. you bring that insight to it.
Because it's on every issue.
Because you know how they operate.
Yes. It wasn't just that issue or just that person. That was the foundational belief. And so when I see...
It's just inhuman, isn't it? Because it's the ideology above all, and the issue and the organization and the activism.
That it's
above.
A fraud.
Yeah.
That they're bringing people in based on this fraud.
Yes.
That this is for women. We're improving people's lives.
Yes.
Oh, no, you're not. And it also transcends... It's not even about the issue of abortion or the issue of rape or sexual harassment or like what Kamala Harris did to Brett Kavanaugh.
Yes.
It is the fact that they are lying to people about what they're doing and what their intentions are.
That's
and
really
on now, not every single Democrat or not every single person who identifies as a feminist. But the fact is that the modern feminist movement really has collapsed because of this. And so you have individuals, though, who continue to propagate that kind of style, whether it be Hillary or Kamala Harris or and this for me as a woman. And I believe women will make and do make a huge difference in society because of our life experiences are so different. And to see these players, representing themselves as, we're who you should look to for the improvement in your life. And I see that same false framework weaved into everything they're doing. And remember, that experience for me was in the early 90s, to mid-90s. It is the 21st century now, and it hasn't stopped.
Yes.
We now have a generation, my generation, that is still imbued with that. And I think that I would regret my experience. However, it's imperative to my it informs me to this day, and it's imperative now when it comes to my analysis of what's happening
really
politically.
Yes, it's really clear to me. It's really, really clear, and it speaks to that point, which, like you said at the beginning, it's that it's completely the opposite of what you might first think superficially, which is, oh yeah, they're, you know, they're liberal, care about people, freedom, you know, emancipation.
Right.
But actually, it's the opposite, because it's not about the individual, it's about the group and the ideology.
That's right. And most of the energy, and this is, I've written about this to some degree, the energy on the left really is to promote, it takes so much energy to promote the collectivism of it, mm-hmm. because it's unnatural.
Mm.
So it's a constant effort to keep everyone in line, because it doesn't, you don't naturally stay in that.
Yeah.
So that's where the energy is. And there's no, there can't be any discussion of new ideas, because there's no space for that. That's why everything you hear is like from the 80s. It's the same arguments. It's the same lies. It's the same huffing and it's always about victimhood. It's the reliance on fear and their reliance on victimhood remaining.
Yeah.
Because without it, what would they offer people?
Other than, right.
When what you offer is to save people from victimhood,
yes.
what do you offer when there's progress, when there's genuine progress? And that is, of course, what it makes Donald Trump so threatening,
mm-hmm.
what any serious conservative, why they're so threatening, is because a genuine conservative argument is about truly freeing people.
Mm-hmm.
And not having a different argument saying, oh, this group of people, you know, nothing bad's happening to them. Bad things are happening. The difference is, let's solve the problem,
that's
as opposed
right.
to raising money on the problem.
Great. I mean, that's
let's
such
solve
a great
the problem.
Summary. Was there a moment when you remember, you sort of coming to the realization of what was really going on, where you, was there a sort of moment of, you know, crossing the line, as it
yes.
were, say, right, I'm now going to be on the right. What was that?
Well, actually about now, I'm not a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a long time to identify even as a conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But what I knew is I wasn't a liberal anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Was during the Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky situation.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Because that was very similar. It was like I was watching this machine operate to destroy a young woman mm-hmm. who had been sexually harassed mm-hmm. and was now being eaten up by mm-hmm. the machine. And then Bill Clinton, they had all the women from the White House go to the outside of the White House and give their speech about how wonderful Bill Clinton is.
Mm-hmm.
When at that point we had known what had happened, and it was like the last straw.
Yeah.
I worked on the 92 Clinton campaign.
Really?
Yes. I worked on the Feinstein Boxer campaigns here.
Uh-huh.
And 1992 was an important year of getting women into the Senate. Bill Clinton elected. Clinton Gore did a great job on the budget. And getting a balanced budget.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they were going to do that, and they did. It was a different Democratic Party. But as a feminist, what I saw was, once again, presenting yourself as one thing, as for them, for the Clintons, as feminists and, you know, the champions for women everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, we've got he's a predator.
Mm-hmm.
People weren't using that word at the time. I did. And that everyone came together to protect him. Waiting to see and kind of just ready to throw Monica Lewinsky into the volcano. And it was like, that's it. That, and it was on the air. I was at KFI. It was like, that's it.
Wow.
And it wasn't new for me. It was like, because I'd accepted this kind of hypocrisy, you know, chose to ignore certain things. And finally, it was like, you've got to be, this is enough. Like, you've got to be kidding.
And so you didn't go, okay, I'm now Republican.
No.
But how did you express that idea of being a conservative? You said that wasn't
well,
labeled.
Well, the interesting thing is also on being on talk radio.
Mm-hmm.
I was, my colleagues at the time when I was with now said, you know, but said I should not do it. You can't do it. It's, you know, it's Rush Limbaugh station. It's, you can't do it. It's awful. And it was interesting to me because it ended up being the opposite of what the feminist and liberal and Democrat people told me it was going to be. But I was talking to conservatives for hours every day on the phone, and they were not what I was told they were.
Right.
That we, you know, they were interesting. They were interested in what I had to say. Nobody wanted to build a camp for me. Nobody was out there with a, you know, a torch waiting to hunt me down after the show, unlike sometimes with liberals. And I thought, well, if I've really been lied to about these people, what else don't I know? What else have I been lied to about? So it manifested at first as me really being free to argue against the liberal framework, mm-hmm. and what was being presented. It was kind of the genesis of hey, everybody, this has been a lie. Mm-hmm. Also, in just my articulating my positions naturally, and I would hear this from the callers at talk radio, mm-hmm. actually fit well within the conservative ideal,
yeah.
which you never heard about because even then, legacy media would never discuss that. Yeah. You wouldn't really know what conservatism was, right? And so that was an education for me. And it was a process of me just being honest about my positions, again, about personal freedom, capitalism, mm-hmm. wanting people to succeed, you know, the importance of a government that doesn't interfere. And look, as a gay woman also, I don't want government to be, whenever government gets involved in our lives, something bad happens.
Yeah,
I want that to end.
Yes.
As a minority, it's not in my interest for yeah. the government to be controlling things. So those conversations we'd have. And so over a period of time, it probably took, a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if it was my first book, which is about freedom of expression, yeah. called The New Thought Police, where I was identifying, well, I shifted from liberal
yes.
to classical liberal.
Yes.
To conservative.
Got it.
And really, even then, since I'm not a Republican, to independent conservative.
Yes.
Which maybe now is our populism.
But that's very interesting, because that would leave you very much as you know, open to, can we just bring it up to date with mm-hmm. Donald Trump? And when you saw
right.
that phenomenon.
Right.
Just tell us about that when you were watching the, well, I guess, 20, you know, just what, more recently, when you're looking at what the Republicans were mm-hmm. doing and Trump, how did that all?
Well, look, the Republicans, I have to say, from what I've seen, do have some problems with people of color, with women. There's a point where they've got to let go and realize that the conservative ideal, if articulated properly, affects everyone and can be embraced by everyone. Mm-hmm. I think for so long now, they've abandoned certain categories of people mm-hmm. because the left, quote, owned them.
Yeah.
So you don't care. You think you can't make a difference in Chicago or Baltimore or mm-hmm. Los Angeles, or, you know, you kind of think that that's not your space.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you really care about the country, every city better yes. be your space.
Yes.
Everybody better be your space. Donald Trump really articulated that. First candidate, really, to hold the rainbow flag, to talk about, hey, African Americans.
That is amazing, isn't it? But that's true. That's
yes.
right.
So, yeah. But he also comes from he doesn't come from within that bubble. He wasn't yes. conditioned into believing that certain categories of people belong in certain spaces. None of that is true. But if you're a politician and you've got to manage big government, you've got to categorize people in that fashion in order to manage it. If you really trust the individual, mm-hmm. you do begin to see everyone as simply American citizens, as an individual. That's when you, if you don't trust people, you can't afford to see people as powerful individuals or relevant as in that framework. You've got to see them as a collective.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, why would you want to deal with them? Because you don't respect them, right? They're things to be managed. Right. Like the, you know, like the pasture or like the pig pen. They're creatures that must be managed and handled.
Yeah.
If you believe in the individual, and I see that from Donald Trump, that you see them and you believe that everyone deserves to be treated in the same way, deserves representation, that identity politics is limiting. I mean, obviously, we have slivers of our identities, but we're American citizens. Mm-hmm. Right. We're complete people. And so I think for me, and how this applies in this process is I found that the leftist rhetoric mm-hmm. Can sound good, but that is developed, in fact, to distract people. And that it's a commitment. Their commitment is to the collective, to dismissing and denigrating the individual. And we see the results of that in the inner cities in
yes.
this country. Donald Trump. And while, of course, they were trying to use they're trying to define him as a misogynist and a sexist, because that category of women was a category Hillary was relying on.
Yep.
she felt they had been conditioned enough to where she could rely on their for them to be unthinking and to just be triggered by certain words. When I would see Donald Trump, my initial reaction was, I didn't like his style. He was not my first choice. But as I listened to the debates and listened to him, there was a realization that this was a man who knew what he was doing, that what needed to happen in the country, he had the skill set for, that in fact, he was interestingly able to face down this kind of monster of a system. He didn't care about them. And he really meant what he was saying about, you know, the things that would make the difference in our lives, which I agreed with, national security, getting that border done. He cared about what happened to Kate Steinle and her family. And I thought to myself, you know, it's the economy that sets us free. Mm-hmm. Women and everyone in this country are more enslaved when you have no money. Mm-hmm. You are genuinely free.
By the way, such a profound point.
Well, you see, because this is, you are only really free when you can make choices that best suit you. Yes. When you're in the relationship because you want to be. When you are living in an area where you can get the school you want, or if you want to send your kid to private school, you don't need to be a millionaire to do those things. You simply need to be middle class and to have a little bit of disposable income. Mm. So it's the economy that will set us free so that we can decide to be CEOs or radio talk show hosts or stay-at-home moms or teachers, whatever we want to do. That nobody else in that lineup who had been in the system could deliver that. We saw the economy collapsing under both Democrats and Republicans, and that this was going to be our chance. And it certainly, we knew it wasn't going to be Hillary, but that was for me, I want a woman president, but I want her to be successful and I want her to improve people's lives. So it was a fascinating juxtaposition. And at a point, I was won over by Donald Trump. And this is the importance of the primary season and those debates and television interviews. I was won over I was not, when it happened, I wasn't hesitant because it made sense. Yeah. And we've all been proven correct at this point, I think.
Yes. And it's interesting. It reminds me of something I thought very much, which at the time, which no one really picked up on particularly. In fact, the opposite, which was, it's quite early on. He was talking about his, you know, rolling out some plans, starting with immigration. I think that was the first policy plan that he put out there very soon after he launched. The next one was his tax plan. And that really persuaded me because it was like, wow, this is so good. This is like someone who really understands. It's incredibly simple. Mm-hmm. It's whatever it was, you know, four rates, big cut in corporate tax. Mm-hmm. That, by the way, had been my obsession when I was back in the UK government, which is if you want to actually get jobs and you've got to get people investing. You've got to get that business confidence.
That's right.
And the corporate tax cut, okay, you can sort of pan it as being for the rich, but it's got to be a dramatic cut. And he wanted 15%. That was one of the things that most persuaded me. Mm-hmm. Like this guy really understands that just shaving off from like whatever, 30 odd to 29 or whatever, is just not going to do it. Anyway, he had this tax plan and then it included a cut in the top rate. And then he gave an interview where he said, well, maybe we won't do the top rate to this or whatever. And he was immediately attacked for flip-flopping and this, that, and the other. Mm. And then he was asked about it in his next interview, and I'll never forget it. He said, look, what I really care about is the corporate tax cut, so we get the economy going, and cutting income tax for working Americans and for middle class people. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I would like to cut it for everyone, but you know what it's like? It's a negotiation. I've got to get it through Congress. Right. I've got to give them something, and I'll probably start by giving them that because what I really care about is this. I thought, oh my God, it's so refreshing. It's someone who, exactly as you said, he really knows what he's talking about.
And there's a transparency.
The process is transparent.
And he was being honest about it.
Exactly. Whereas everyone else, they just go, they will promise you this, and then they know it's never going to happen. He's just describing, and I just thought, wow.
Yes, and in that process, also we watched everyone else freak out. I thought to myself, this is genuine. Nobody was freaking out about Hillary. That's kind of weird. And yet this man, for some reason, was such a threat. That interested me.
Yes.
You know, what was that was the case? And it was, you know, it's really the right man at the right time.
Yeah.
And the transparency, it's still kind of shocking to people.
Yes.
If sometimes, you know, it's like, please don't say as much on Twitter and whatever. It's like we can handle it.
Of course.
It's okay. We
and
can
I think,
do it.
Funny enough, you know, when people talk about his character and the way he behaves, and you get all these people leaking out of the White House and all the rest of it. It seems to me that one of the things that must, I mean, two plus years into it now, I'm not surprised he explodes every now and again, because it seems to me that he just from the beginning just didn't have enough people around him who sort of got him and
right.
got what he was trying to do and helped him. Instead, he had all these people blocking him.
Well, plus he was genuinely in the beginning trying to bring everyone together.
Yeah.
In genuine leadership. I mean, remember, it seems like a million years ago now, but Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon.
That's right, exactly.
I mean, think of the genuine effort to try to make all of this work. And he's been learning. And it's been, I'm sure it's been very disappointing to him that, in fact, these are not well-meaning people. It's always people make a mistake about the Democrats. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're well-meaning. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I think he's realized that this is a zero-sum game for people who don't think, who are not thinking about the country first. Mm-hmm. And they think too highly of themselves. And they underestimate him because mm-hmm. he's, you know, I don't know, it's just that he didn't go to the right schools or what their issue is.
I think it's exactly right, by the way. It's a kind of class and snobbery
yes.
and kind of, I use this word, like he's not to their taste.
Yes, exactly. You know,
they literally can't believe he eats McDonald's.
And
that's disqualifying for
them.
He
exposes them and their fraud simply by existing. Through his transparency, I don't think we can have another president who isn't as available.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so that became also a threat. But I think that it was his greatest strength and weakness. He's trying to bring everyone together to get work done like you would in a company. Who doesn't want the company to succeed? Well, some people don't. And so now he's still refining the nature of who we can trust and who he's having around him. And he's learned. And I think that it's going to be a raucous 2 years. The Democrats will continue to overreach. And the president will need to, I think he understands, to make sure that the American people, that he's going to have to get over legacy media to mm-hmm. make sure the American people know genuinely what's happened in this country, mm-hmm. why they are better off. That's his specialty. He'll be able to do that. And this will be a multiple cycle reformation.
Yes.
And who he runs with in 2020 will also be important. I don't think he can be Mike Pence. I think I'm sure he's a lovely man. I've never met him. And I've only met the president briefly once. But when it comes to what the argument of the left is going to be and what some of the problems that the Republicans have had when it mm-hmm. comes to women is, I think, and I've been saying this for a while, but I think a Trump-Nikki Haley ticket is something that will make will rock the Democrats' world because their plans will be changed. And I think someone like Nikki Haley is certainly supportive of the president, loyal to him. Has her own point of view, has now some extraordinary experience, has Americans like her, as she is clearly
she's very impressive.
Been under such pressure. I think she would be a very interesting addition because we also have to think about 2024. The reformation, we can't have a Reagan handoff to a Bush again, mm-hmm. where then the effort is to reverse the success. Mm-hmm. The reformation must continue. And, you know, because the swamp is waiting just for 2024.
That's exactly right. They can't wait. I think, and just the last point I just wanted to sort of pick up on there and conclude with this, is that what you've done so brilliantly, I think, is it goes back to what you said at the beginning, which I love, I really, so much, which is, you know, as far as you see it, populism is the best bits of conservatism.
Yeah.
And the thing that's really helpful, and I think for anyone listening to sort of take from that, is when we talk about populism, it's a label that has, you know, like, and one of the things I constantly try and kind of find ways of doing is differentiating between the populism of the left and the populism of the right. Because
right.
a lot of the time, oh, well, there's a lot of, you know, overlap. Bernie Sanders sounded like Trump. He railed against the rig. Yes, that's true. A lot of rhetorical overlap. And also an overlap in terms of the kinds of people they were saying they were concerned about, the American worker rather than the elites and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that, as far as it goes, there is that overlap. But it's the policies and the means that really differ. And that point about populism being the best of conservatives in the sense of putting power in people's hands, mm-hmm. giving them that individual freedom.
And you need the conservative...
Especially economically.
Yes.
So important.
And you need the conservative... It can only work within the... as being facilitated through the conservative ideal because it requires trust in the individual.
Yes.
The left does not trust the individual. The left is committed to collectivism,
yeah.
which, of course, is the antithesis of populism. It cannot work. Populism requires the freedom of the individual, genuine freedom, to be able to really seek your dreams, have your yes. lives be what you want it to be. But that can only be facilitated by the conservative ideal. And so I consider the rest of that, if you're on the left, you can't be a populist. You
this
can't
is brilliant.
Be.
Tell me, it's so good what you just said. It's just brilliant. I'm going to leave it there.
Okay.
Because I want to reflect on all that, and I want to talk about it another time with you, because that was so important. It's a profound thing to say.
Well, I...
It's
this
very,
is,
very... It's very, very deep what you just said.
And only your point of view could we have this conversation. It allows the foundation of this great podcast, larger conversation about the important issues
yeah.
kinds of bring
yeah, we're
brings
keep,
these
we're
things
up. Keep going.
Good.
Hey, Tammy Bruce.
Hey.
Fantastic.
Hey, Steve Hilton.
Thank you so much.
Thanks Wonderful. For having me.
No, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.